Hello and welcome back to Crime Cats, True Crime Podcast. I'm Jackie, and today we'll be talking about the life and crimes of America's first known and documented serial killer, H.H. Holmes. So thanks for listening, and please follow us on all social media. You can find us on Facebook at Crime Cats, a True Crime Podcast, where we also have our awesome discussion group, and we are on Instagram at crimecat.truecrime. Also want to give a shout out to my boyfriend Rob for creating our new theme song / intro,
which we love.
Yes, super Stranger Things, exactly what we wanted. Thanks, babe.
Beat these children. Crime Cats, True Crime Podcast. Today we have a very special guest. My amazing husband, Cullen, is here for the very first time.
Hello.
He's joining us today on a case he is a pretty big fan of. He knows a lot about this case. He loves to go down rabbit holes, just like I do. Probably more so, actually. He gets so wrapped up sometimes that I wake up at 4 a.m. and go to the bathroom, and he's still reading about 15th century war tactics.
It's Wikipedia wormholes.
So just like crime is our thing, his thing is history. So he's going to talk to us about the history of this case and tie in some interesting Cullen facts. Today our episode is the absolute insane story of America's first documented serial killer, H.H. Holmes, and his murder castle. Have you ever heard of this case, Jackie?
I have heard of it, but I haven't dug into it a lot. I've heard, you know, what's out there, but
yeah. Well, just to let you guys know, this will be a long case, so everyone get real comfy. I also heavily relied on some key articles that ended up being my favorites, mainly from Murderpedia and The Lineup. We do have a new website, and these links will be on our website, as well as our show notes and pictures, and pretty much we'll be starting to do a blog post for each case.
Yeah, and we'll let you guys know the website at the end of the show and post it on our social media as well.
Yes. So we're just going to jump right in since this was such a long one. This story begins in the late 1800s. A serial killer is terrorizing the Windy City of Chicago with an elaborate maze of death traps and torture devices built into a massive three-story hotel that took up the entire block of 63rd and Wallace Street. Dr. Henry Howard Holmes, a.k.a. H.H. Holmes, who actually was born Herman Webster, and I don't know how to quite say this last name because it's weird,
Mudgett.
It looks like, it just makes me, I don't know, it's weird. Mudgett.
Do we get into why his name changed?
We do.
Okay.
It's like budget.
Budget Mudgett. Maybe that's why he changed it, because it's embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
To anyone whose last name's Mudgett.
We still love him. He ended up confessing to killing 27 people in what became known again as his murder castle. Although some people have some accounts, his victims may range from anywhere from only two people to more than 200. But due to the way he disposed bodies, there's really no way to tell how many exactly, because of, you'll see why. The way he disposed, it's very hard to tell. And to me, the existence of this ruthless murderer like H.H. Holmes is seriously terrifying. He's the scariest kind of killer. good looks, charming, manipulative, very smart. Some people see him as an incarnation of evil. Others saw him as an example of what greed and childhood trauma can do to an otherwise normal person. Holmes was born May 16, 1861, in a small town called Gilmington in New Hampshire to Levi Horton Mudgett and Theodate Page Price. What a name.
Those Theodate. Are some names. Those
yeah. Are... Theodate. That one I was like, I've literally never heard that name. But, you know, olden times. They were actually descendants from the first English immigrants to the area. He was his parents' third-born child out of five kids. He had an older sister, Ellen, an older brother, Arthur, a younger brother, Henry, and a younger sister, Mary. Holmes's father was from a farming family. He also was a farmer himself. He sometimes did trading work and sometimes house painted. His parents were devout Methodists and were also very strict. They demanded total obedience from him. Later attempts to fit Holmes into a pattern of modern serial killers, they described him torturing animals and suffering abuse from the hands of his father, but there's no hard proof of any of that. Prior to marriage, his mother was a school teacher. She was described as a cold and distant woman who used religion as a daily guide for parenting. His father was known as an alcoholic and followed a strict disciplinarian approach, and again, supposedly resulted in physical abuse. Some reports from Concordia University says that Holmes's parents were both physically and mentally abusive towards him, and that the harsh disciplinarian tactics included prolonged isolation and sometimes even food deprivation, which that's just terrible. Like, you're going to starve your kid because he doesn't listen to you and doesn't do his homework or some crap.
Like, that's probably why he doesn't listen to you, because, I mean, you can't treat children like that and expect them to act good.
Right.
I mean, we grew up with that kind of stuff being normalized. Go to bed without supper.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. I didn't even think of it that way.
But going to bed without supper is totally different than starving your child.
If you know my family, that obviously never happens.
No. It never would happen.
We're all well fed.
Oh my God, Boris is on top of the refrigerator. Our cat's on top of the refrigerator. That's all fine. Typical Boris. So his father also reportedly held kerosene rags over Holmes and the other children's mouths to quiet them while they were crying.
As you do.
That's an idea.
Right? Like, okay, you won't stop? Well, I'm just going to gas you.
Right?
Does this smell like chloroform?
Right?
What does it smell like?
God. During these instances of abuse from his father, Holmes found refuge in the forest near his home. It was in this forest there he began dissecting animals and developing his deviant fascinations for things both dead and alive.
Wow.
Holmes's experiments with animals continued through his childhood. Initially, he began by dissecting reptiles, but later moved on to rabbits.
It's part of the McDonald triad.
Yes. Rabbits, cats, and dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Especially cats. I feel like cats gets the brunt of it. Why is that? And dogs.
Because there's a... I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and they're more... Cats and dogs are more pets. So yeah. There's more of a... I think there's more of a closeness to actually killing a person.
Yeah,
because you form bonds with cats and dogs.
Like, I'm surprised about rabbits. That's, you know, true. How hard it is to catch a wild rabbit?
Right? They're so fast.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy. But not only did this experiments with animals provide Holmes with flesh-cutting skills at a young age, but it also acted as a psychological facilitator for his later obsession with human anatomy. For Holmes, assessing medical information was relatively easy. In fact, Holmes's morbid curiosity may have led him to killing his childhood friend at age 11. Holmes, although was a reclusive child, did have an older friend named Tom from his neighborhood. One day, while exploring an abandoned home together, Holmes recalls witnessing Tom die by falling off a landing. However, there is speculation that Holmes was standing close enough behind Tom that he may have actually intentionally pushed him off the ledge.
What?
Yeah. At 11. I mean, that's
horrible.
That is. It's crazy. Holmes's parents were not the only contributing factor to his abusive upbringing. As a kid, Holmes was bullied and abused in school for his good grades and his odd demeanor. The most noted of these experiences occurred when Holmes, blindsided by classmates, was forced into a doctor's office where the hands of a skeleton were forcibly placed over his face. Holmes later said that this event was the reason for his curiosity and about anatomy, which later led him to pursue a degree at the University of Michigan Medical School in 1884. I mean, it's pretty traumatic if you're, like, not a fan of the doctor's office. Yeah. And I can relate because I'm terrified of the dentist. And I can't imagine, like, being, like, trapped in, like, a dentist chair or something.
Well, yeah, I get that. I'm not really afraid of either of those, so I don't know.
We also didn't use polymer skeletons back then. That was, like,
that was a real skeleton.
A dead person's hands person. That they yeah. put on his face. So.
Yeah, it's pretty gross.
Yeah.
It is possible that Holmes, who was known as, like, an intelligent loner type, was so traumatized by the abuse that he'd suffered in childhood that it ultimately led to his inability to form meaningful relationships. This abuse may also have contributed to his penchant for lies, swindling, and abusing others.
Yes, serial killers are actually 36 times more likely to have experienced physical abuse in their childhood than the average person.
Really?
So that shows.
Man.
I didn't know that.
I feel like not only is the physical abuse a thing, but, like, mental abuse is a really big problem.
I think mental abuse may screw people up more than physical abuse sometimes. Yeah. You know?
We were talking the other night about maternal abuse, like, because of that bond you have with your mother, how when you're abused by your mother at a young age, you are unable to have successful bonds
with
in
people.
The future. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's yeah. the one person that you're supposed to trust yeah. no matter what.
Yeah.
And that trust was broken.
Yep. Well, in 1878, at the young age of 17, Holmes convinced a beautiful young Clara Levering of Alton, New Hampshire, to marry him. Clara was the daughter of a wealthy local farmer. Unfortunately for Clara, the marriage may have simply been a means of financial gain for Holmes. Because a year later, after graduating from high school, he left Clara and enrolled in the University of Michigan Medical School at Ann Arbor. Holmes used Anna's money to pay his tuition. Swindling women out of their fortune later became a favorite tactic for Holmes. At one point, he had three different wives in three different cities, and none of the women knew about each other. Which,
I can barely handle one spouse.
Right?
Or, like, I don't even know.
Like, that is some juggling acts.
Right? But if you think about it, back then, they didn't have social media. They didn't have text messaging. It's easy to hide stuff like that.
Either send a telegraph or a letter.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially if they're, like, far away, like these people all were. It's not like they were, like,
history. Most people never left their hometown. So.
True.
Yeah.
True. But still insane, nonetheless. Because, like I said earlier, Holmes was very charming, persuasive, and handsome. He was very good at conning women. He apparently had these piercing, deep blue eyes that would just make women do whatever he wanted.
Overrated.
He was...
I personally love blue eyes.
Yeah. Blue eyes, green eyes, brown eyes.
I think everybody I've dated has had blue eyes.
Really?
Yeah.
Colin has hazel eyes. Yeah, he would get these women to literally take out life insurances, naming him as the beneficiary when they barely knew him. With each mistress that he had, they would eventually go missing. He would concoct elaborate stories to why they left him, quote unquote. Then in medical school, he began robbing graves and morgues. and sold the cadavers to medical schools or utilized them in his swindling of insurance companies or even performing his own research on them.
Yeah, do y'all want me to get into some of the history behind that? Because I have notes.
Yeah, let's hear it.
A big thing that drove the grave robbing back then was universities. Usually the professor of anatomy in a medical college was the one responsible for obtaining the bodies. Like the college was just like, yeah, you're on your own. You get to go do this.
Figure it out.
But they would have a fund that he would just pull from, and they weren't worried about the sources. They didn't care where they came from as long as it was a relatively fresh corpse. And they would have their grad students and med students kind of waiting when they knew they had a body coming in. And they just grab it at the door and snatch it inside. And one of the first things they do, they'd cut the eyes out, the nose off, the ears off. They'd cut the fingerprints off, the scalp, anything that you could identify a loved one by. Because there was one instance where a man, his wife, her grave had been disturbed. He found out because a relative was visiting her grave a few days after the funeral and noticed that the dirt was all stirred up. So back then, that all immediately pointed towards it had been grave robbed. So he went to the local medical college, and they kind of gave him the runaround about whether she'd been grave robbed. And then a medical student pulled him to the side and said, yeah, we have your wife. We didn't know it was your wife, but I will help you out. So the student takes him down to the refrigerated basement. Body's not the room where he says it is. They hear a door slam down the hall. They run down the hall. There's nobody down the hall. They hear a door slam down a further hall. They were moving her body on a gurney from room to room
to keep
him from getting his wife's body. Eventually, it ended up going to court. And even the police chief was in on it, covering for the medical college because he was getting kickbacks to overlook the grave robbers. Like, it was an industry.
Wow.
So it was basically the grave robbers. They had a pretty name for it. It was called Resurrectionists, you know, to church it up a little bit. And it would usually be a 3-man team, one guy waiting about a block away in a wagon, two guys at the site. It'd take about an hour and a half. You had one guy digging, one guy watching, and they'd swap out. And they would bring a big canvas tarp and lay that around the grave so you could throw the dirt on it so it wouldn't disturb the area around it. And you'd have one guy digging, and they would dig at the head of the grave. So you've got the tombstone and then the rest of the grave in front of it. Mm-hmm. They would dig the front 3 or 4 feet. And once they got down to the coffin, they'd break open the top portion of the coffin, loop a rope around under the arms, and snatch you up out of the grave.
And wow.
They would put the wood back on from the coffin, rebury it, lay the turf back over the top, and it looked like it never happened. They also used wooden shovels because it didn't make any noise compared to a metal shovel.
Oh, that's interesting.
You could get, translated into today's money, you could get roughly, depending on the condition of the body, they preferred younger men and younger women, like in their late teens, early 20s. But they would really take anybody if it was fresh enough. But for a prime condition body, you get the equivalent of about $2,500 today.
Let's go. I got some bills to pay.
Don't know a lot of people around that would say no to $2,500 for snatching people out of the grave.
Yeah.
Not like he's going to be upset.
Yeah, true.
And you can put him back when he's done.
Well, the bodies that Holmes would snatch were always about money. Or some type of educational type of experiment for his own, you know, stuff.
Ooh, can I butt in one more?
Of course.
I have one more note. Sorry. I forgot to mention this part. I think y'all will be really interested in this. Women were a very huge part of the resurrectionist business.
Huh.
They would hire women to act, to play the part of grieving relatives.
Ooh.
And go claim the bodies of the dead at the poorhouses for people who didn't have relatives to claim them. So they'd hire so-and-so from down the street who's down on her luck. They'd pay her to go to the poorhouse where somebody had died, some homeless person had died, and they go, oh, this is my old uncle, so-and-so.
Oh, wow.
And
They give her a little kickback.
Yeah, and so they would send them to the funerals to act like long distant relatives.
Wow,
no one's going to question them.
Professional mourners. Like,
no one's going to cause a scene at a funeral. And go, well, I've never recognized you.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If y'all were ever down really hard up on your luck, you could
go walk around downtown Mobile,
pretend to be a homeless guy's sister,
call around a homeless person until he dies.
Someone's her. Twice removed. Cousin-in-law.
Yeah.
Claim their body.
Exactly. Wow.
Well, now it would just be a financial burden.
True. They come after you for all the debt.
Right.
Oh, so you're handling the funerals.
Cool. Here, pay $3,500. Well,
people denying relatives now.
Right, exactly.
I've never seen that guy in my life.
Lord of the state. Well, Holmes, he was conning the insurance companies, creating pseudonyms for himself and then naming himself as the beneficiary to take a life insurance out on a fake person. To complete the ruse, he would then steal a cadaver and he would have to disfigure it to make it unrecognizable. Just like you were talking about having to take the nose off, the eyes, the fingers, and whatnot. Working in Holmes' favor was his, again, attractiveness and mysteriousness. On the surface, he appeared genuine, caring, but beneath that was a facade of manipulative and fraudulent businessmen who used his intellect and charm to promote his calculated scams. He was very, very smart, mm-hmm. and used it to his financial gain. During this time, Holmes was ignored by his wife.
Which one? Damn it!
Well, at this time, he's still only married to Clara. So Clara is his only wife currently. He pretty much just acts like she doesn't exist until he eventually receives $12,500 on a single life insurance scam that he eventually just completely abandons her, doesn't talk to her at all after that. Then he went on to graduate medical school in 1884 and received his MD. And went on to use this title to create his lasting alias of Dr. Henry Howard Holmes. So his actual medical degree was with that name.
Okay.
So that was now his legal name.
It was way too easy to change shit up.
You just literally just told them, hey, this is my name. And that's what they did.
I've changed my name 3 times and it's been a pain in the ass.
It's so hard to change your name now. God. Yeah. But I mean, I get it. Yeah. I don't want someone stealing my name or something. Right. But being as he was a doctor now, it gave him access to tools and resources he needed for killing. Then after graduation, he traveled to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and got a job as a doctor, his first job as a doctor, anyway, at Norristown State Hospital. But after a few days, he quit. I don't know why. I couldn't find that out, but he didn't like that job. So he went on to find a different position, still in Philadelphia, as a pharmacist. But while he was working there for a short time, a boy died after taking medicine that was purchased in the store. Holmes, of course, denied any involvement in the child's death and immediately left the city. It was then when Holmes arrived in Chicago in August 1886. Shortly after arriving, he came across Dr. E.S. Holton's drugstore at the southwest corner of South Wallace Avenue and West 63rd Street in Inglewood. Now, I've read several different stories about what happens next. We do know for sure that Dr. Holton was ill, and Dr. Holton's wife was running the drugstore. By some accounts, Holmes quickly talked himself into a job and began working as the pharmacist, and he proved to be a hardworking employee and eventually bought the store. But several books and articles I've read portray Holton's husband as an old man who quickly vanished along with his wife, assumed to have been murdered by Holmes. But some other accounts say that Dr. Holton was a fellow Michigan alumnus, and he was actually only a couple of years older than Holmes, and that both the Holtons remained in Inglewood throughout Holmes's life and actually survived well into the 20th century. Either way, during this time, Holmes is definitely known to have been running the pharmacy and eventually definitely bought it from Dr. Holton. This is where it really all begins for him. Not long after buying the drugstore, Holmes purchased the lot across the street where construction began in 1887 for a two-story mixed-use building with apartments on the second floor and retail space, including a new drugstore on the first floor.
Hmm.
Wonder what that's going to happen in this house. Holmes then hired assistant Mr. Benjamin Peitzel, who will become a pretty large part of the story. They began construction on his new venture, which, in usual Holmes fashion, would be financed largely through fraud and credit that he would obviously never pay back because he's Holmes. In 1892, he added a third floor, telling investors and suppliers that he intended to use it as a hotel for the upcoming World Columbian Exposition, a.k.a. the World's Fair. Now, I didn't know much about the World's Fair until recently. Me and Cullen went into a YouTube hole learning about the World's Fair because I read this book that was really interesting to me. It was called The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. And it was really kind of focusing on H.H. Holmes and the architects from the Chicago's World's Fair and how H.H. Holmes really, really affected the World's Fair. And that place is bananas.
What is it exactly?
So it's like a fair, but it's like the first of so many things were like...
It's like an exposition of that from all over the world.
Okay.
Like different countries would have their own booths. Like, you remember the little international fairs they'd have at high schools or schools growing up?
Mm-hmm.
It's like that. Or like if you go to like the French Market in New Orleans, all the little stalls set up. Like this is the stall with the... people from Belgium, and they have Belgium things, like French fries and mayonnaise and waffles.
Showing off what they...
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I gotcha.
And, you know, there were some really cool things that premiered there. Cracker Jacks.
Yep.
Really?
What was the gum?
Juicy Fruit.
Juicy Fruit.
Juicy Fruit was premiered at the Chicago World's Fair.
Yep. There's all kinds of things like that you think of, like, as an American tradition.
I want to say it was one of the... first things marketed as hot dogs.
Yeah, hot dogs.
Also, like a bunch of like fair food, corn dogs, I think also were premiered.
When we were listening to it, I was just like, oh my God, all of this stuff is just so American now. And it's so cool that it became from there.
Like, oh, you heard about this new thing? It's a meat log inside of a piece of bread.
Yeah. So although he was married to Clara Loverling, Lovering. Holmes then met a woman, Marta.
Myrta. Myrtle Beach, maybe.
Myrta. I don't know. M-Y-R-T.
Myrta from Minneapolis.
She's from Minneapolis. He coaxed her into coming to Chicago.
It's like, well, okay.
And then again, although he's married to someone else, he then marries her. 2 weeks later,
my day, you could have three wives,
right?
And we liked it that way.
Well, he then did actually file for divorce from Clara, but then he bought a house in Wilmette, which is about 25 miles from Chicago. It was close enough to visit her, but not too close to impede his nefarious crimes without any interruption. So due to a plentitude of desperate laborers, because at this time, Chicago had already went through a really hard time with employment. They were pretty much like largely unemployed in the Chicago, like downtown area. Lots of people were unemployed. Weren't there fires recently?
Yeah.
There were like recently like lots of like the Chicago fire. The Great Chicago Fire.
Burned down half the city.
It had just ravaged. And so there was not many jobs because lots of businesses were closed. So with Holmes, you know, building this giant monstrosity of a place, everyone was like just showing up at his door like, hey, hire me.
He also employed someone to build a furnace. In the basement, kind of like a kiln, or If anyone's in the funerary business, it might be called a retort.
Oh.
Where you put grandpa.
Ooh, like a crematorium.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't revealed or wasn't noticed until after all of his crimes were over that the person who installed the furnace realized that, yeah, this thing doesn't even make smoke. It burns so hot, so it'd be perfect for getting rid of bodies. Mm. But he claimed it was for making glass, and I guess they assumed since he was also running a drugstore, your chemist or your druggist also is what they called them, they would make their own pipettes and beakers and all that kind of other stuff.
So it made sense for
them. They didn't give it a second thought. They're like, well, of course this guy's trustworthy. Look at his mustache.
Yeah. Which I don't think I pointed on that, but he does. He has this huge mustache that's like really thick.
Virgil Earp from Tombstone.
Yes. Mustache. Like a huge mustache.
I need to post like a link to a picture.
Oh, we're going to post him on our website and our Instagram and all that good stuff. Well, one of these workers that he had hired was a man named Ned Connor. He was a pharmacist who he had hired to work in the drugstore. Holmes began paying close attention to Ned's sister, Gertrude.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long before Holmes had instigated an affair with Gertrude.
Oh, Gertie.
But for poor Gertie, there was no marriage in the picture.
Oh, Gert.
And Gert. She was pretty embarrassed because the affair was come to light that he was having an affair with a married man. So she fled back to Iowa in shame.
Where nothing good happens.
Right. She went back to her corn. And then, you know, where it's nice and cold all the time. Mm-hmm. And then she fell ill and died. Holmes went on to use his good looks and charm to then seduce Ned's wife, Julia. Around this time, Holmes actually sold his pharmacy to Ned. Holmes likely was trying to avoid his debt by making the sale. He's like, oh, here, why don't you buy this from me so I don't have to pay back all these people? And creditors then started showing up at the pharmacy demanding payment. And now Ned is the rightful owner of the pharmacy. He inherited all of Holmes' unpaid debts. So
fun.
Poor old Ned is just getting short into all these sticks.
Yeah, poor Ned.
With Julia and Holmes' affair ongoing, her relationship with Ned had grown strained and tumultuous. Eventually, Ned abandoned the pharmacy, Julia, and their daughter Pearl to Holmes, moving out of town and filing for divorce. With Ned out of the picture, though, Holmes grew a lot less interested in Julia.
It sounds like he was only interested in the challenge of
pursuing.
He likes the pursuit.
He likes the pursuit of conning people.
And when they love him,
he's like, this is boring.
He's like, man, go away.
Yeah. So he then turns his attention elsewhere. Yet when Julia surprised him with an announcement that she was pregnant. Oh, sorry. Holmes actually agreed to marry her, but with one stipulation. She allowed him to perform an abortion.
Which I'm sure.
Allowed him to perform it?
Yes.
Is he that kind of medical doctor?
Mm-hmm.
Well, even if he was, that was back then, that was still kind of a touch and go operation.
Yeah.
Like, probably not the safest thing in the world to go through. In 1890.
In the back alley, you know.
Well, on Christmas Eve, Holmes subdued Julia with chloroform under the guise of performing this abortion. He then disposed of his newly betrothed. So he killed her.
On purpose?
On purpose. He was just telling her that he was going to perform an abortion and then killed her while she was under the chloroform, so she didn't fight back. Then he murdered her poor little girl, Pearl, as well.
Oh, that's awful.
Right. Neighbors, of course, paid attention to this because she had been there for a long time at this point.
Yeah.
Holmes, of course, had a lie ready that she had suddenly left to go be with her sister in Iowa. At this time, vanishings in Chicago were extremely commonplace. And with the corrupt police force, no one paid attention unless someone wealthy disappeared.
And they're paid off half the time.
They were definitely paid off. And again, like we were talking about earlier, the bodies that are found are immediately given to medical colleges or hospitals. Mm-hmm. And the skeletons were stripped or sold to doctors, museums, private collectors. Knowing this, Holmes paid a specialist to turn Julia's cadaver into a cleansed skeleton and then sold the skeleton to a medical college in Chicago.
He nasty.
That's pretty bad.
And on Christmas Eve?
Right. That poor little girl.
That's sad.
By 1892, the hotel was mostly...
That's a good year.
When Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Oh, wait.
That's, yeah. So it still rhymes. The hotel was mostly completed at this time with three stories and a basement. The first floor, again, was the storefront. The second story was supposedly apartments.
Say all that again fast. The second story was supposedly apartments.
Which I will have a picture of the actual, like, layout of the murder castle. I found a really good picture of it.
It's complex.
It's a castle.
But it took up a whole block.
It did. An entire city block.
Dracula or something.
Right.
You want to think about castle?
Well, it doesn't look like that. It's just...
I know.
It is a complex more than a castle, but it's huge. It's massive. So the second floor was apartments, but it also housed his elaborate torture rooms, which contained a chute that led to the basement for the bodies.
Wee.
Murder shoot.
Makes me think of the kamikaze at Waterboy.
Right. Pew. Will you get me another drink? Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
We gotta get these Trulies in. Well, in 1894, some police and officers were inspecting the hotel while Holmes was out. Now, this is where it could have ended, but it didn't.
Bum, bum, bum.
During the inspection, they found rooms with hinged walls, false partitions, rooms linked with secret passageways, and even airtight rooms that were connected to pipelines.
Okay, so I don't know if you're going to tell me this or not and later, but is this thing still open? You can, like, tour it?
No.
Oh.
No, I know.
Oh,
bummer.
It actually burned down.
It did.
Oh.
Supposedly by Holmes.
Yeah.
Which furniture.
Makes sense.
Are we going to get there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Spoilers.
Spoiler alert!
Everyone in this story's dead now.
They all died.
Holmes used these, also he used chutes to deliver the bodies, like we talked about earlier.
That's so...
I mean, can you just imagine it? Like, this is so macabre, but, like, just a body sliding down.
Like,
where if y'all can see me now, like... Where do you think they got the idea on Jeepers Creepers?
Oh, yes.
Oh, right.
Jeepers Creepers. Where'd you get those Jeepers?
That movie.
Just with no movie. Belly button throwing stars.
It's probably one of the scariest movies. And
I hate it.
It still creeps me out.
I hate it.
Really, me too.
I've never watched the first one.
What?
The first one is the scary one.
That is the worst one.
From start to finish.
Well... We should still watch it.
Screeching. The second one. I actually saw the second one for the first one.
Oh, really? That's funny. Well, he would use the chutes, obviously, to go to the basement. Not himself, the bodies. where he had surgical tables and an array of medical tools, and he would dissect them and then sell them a lot of the times to the medical institutions. So his neighborhood was then chosen for the site of the fair. So not his neighborhood, but very close to his neighborhood, called Jackson Park, was chosen for the World Fair. Holmes was then set to become not only very rich from renting out the hotel, but also set up with a steady stream of young female victims.
Mm-hmm.
Holmes's plan was to lure as many unwilling victims as possible into his murder castle between 1890 and 1893. Then, after the World's Fair, he would burn the building to the ground to collect the insurance money and destroy whatever evidence remained. Also, this is funny, to help deflect any future suspicion, Holmes went on so far to attempt to befriend officers of the local police precinct. So that's got some Kemper vibes to it.
Remember? A little bit.
Yeah, he would go hang out with the police and be like, hey, buddy.
Try the egg salad.
So, yeah, he, you know, and he was so good at, like, being normal that the police were like, oh, yeah, he's a good old doctor. We'll be friends with him. And he probably gave him free medical care.
True.
Around the same time, Holmes' assistant, Benjamin Peitzel, and he's been his assistant ever since he started this pharmacy, he visited Dwight, Illinois, seeking a cure for alcoholism. There, he met a young...
Stop drinking.
Emmeline, right? Right. Emmeline Sigrand?
Maybe Emmeline Sigrand.
There we go, that one. And returned to Chicago with an ostrich description of her that Holmes immediately sent her invitation to come to Chicago and be his personal secretary. So this beautiful 24-year-old woman came to Chicago, never meeting Holmes, only corresponding via letter, and found her quickly ensconced in Holmes' web of seduction and deceit.
Girl.
She got sconced.
Sconced
her up.
Yep. He's crazy, cunning, fans, charming. Holmes told Emmeline that he had claims to an English lordship, and that...
Okay, well, that's a little... It is.
Cullen, like, on our first date was like, here, look at my lord's card. And I was like, okay, you can have it.
For my 25th birthday, my grandma bought me a 1 square foot... of property in Glencoe, Scotland, and you get a little business card with it, and it officially makes you a Lord of Glencoe.
Well,
so, well, I mean, it's true. It's true. Just, you can go stand in it.
You can go stand in your wood
stand in the property. You can put a bird feeder up.
That's funny.
Well, Emmeline then was super excited to have her lord.
Maybe he had a little business card too.
He may have. And she pretty much became quickly infatuated with him.
As one would do.
As one does. Even though he was already married, Holmes then...
Did she know?
No, okay. She didn't marry. Well, because he's technically married. I don't know if he ever actually got divorced.
I can't keep up with
Clara. I can't either.
So his first wife is Clara, and he supposedly filed for divorce, but there is no actual divorce decree. So he was married and then filed for divorce, but she never signed the divorce papers. And then her second one, Marta, who lives in Chicago, but kind of far out, like in the suburbs. And then now he's trying to get married for the third time to Emmeline.
Oh, we're only on number three?
Only on number
three.
I
thought she had more than that.
Well, he's had several...
In between
women, gotcha. But not proposed.
Okay.
So Emmeline agreed to marry him. And though she was smart, she quickly got kind of suspicious of his activities. And then, you know, with her suspicion, she asked him, hey, what's up, man? Why are you doing these weird things?
Yeah.
And then he quickly disposed of her.
Well, you don't really ask that if you're thinking something's up.
Maybe she isn't that smart. Yeah.
She caught on.
She caught on.
Leonard Skinner song, Don't Ask Me No Questions.
Won't tell you no lies.
Yeah. You did tell a lie.
Don't ask me about my business.
Mind your business, lady. Well, her family was like, hey, where's Emmeline? And Holmes responded with a tale that she had married someone else and departed. Well, we never found her. No one ever found her. Her body was never discovered. Still to this day, no one knows what happened to her.
I bet she died.
I'm pretty sure he killed her.
I'm pretty positive that happened too.
Yeah, he probably ground her up into mush, knowing him. She's probably in that, in the kiln. Well, that's only a part one, you guys. We are going to actually go ahead and cut this off and put this into a two-parter because I still have tons left. We're about halfway through. Yeah. So, so this is the end of part one, which we will quickly move on to part two.
Don't forget to like, comment, subscribe.
All right, YouTube. Colin's a YouTuber.
Show us some love on the YouTube.
We do need
upvotes. Upvotes to the left. That's
Reddit. But really, do follow us on Instagram at crimecrats.truecrime and on our Facebook group, and find our discussion group and let us know what you want to hear about.
Shoot us a fax.
Send it via snail mail at P.O. Box 222.
No. We really don't have one.
We don't.
Smoke signals, telegraph. I work on
a tugboat. We do have a Gmail, though.
A blimp.
I work on a tugboat, so I know Morse.
Yeah. Morse code. Some Morse code. All right, guys. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on part two. Stay spooky.